we're coming back to look at this passage that deals with that great spiritual and moral system that will rule as far as the hearts and minds of men are concerned in the last days. One of the things that we will want to do this evening is to look at what the passage says about the scope of this woman's influence. Now we have before us the illustration of a wicked, evil, debauched woman used of a spiritual system, of a moral influence that grips, rules, directs the hearts and minds of men. It is an influence, as we have seen, that promotes idolatry. It promotes apostasy from God in the name of the pursuit of pleasure and the indulgence of the appetites of man's flesh, the pursuit of drunkenness, the pursuit of prosperity, the pursuit of immorality. It's like this evil woman ruling in the hearts and minds of men. The Lord Jesus talked about, a great deal about, how things would be immediately prior to His return. One of the things that He said about that period of earth's history, the months and years that lead up to His coming again, is recorded for us in Luke chapter 17. These will be familiar words to you, I know. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise also, as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now you may never have connected these two passages before, but there you have simply another statement of what John is telling us in Revelation 17 of the Spirit that will grip the hearts and minds of men in the days before the Lord's return. There is this indulgence of pleasure, this indulgence of licentious evil living, the pursuit of prosperity is here. All of these things that John speaks of, the Savior has spoken of as well. This will be the character of the last days. More and more we see these things today. We see men living only for their own pleasure, without regard to the consequences. As Paul taught Timothy concerning the apostasy of the last days, men will be lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Now it's interesting that he brings those two things together when he writes to Timothy. Lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, because I believe we are to understand that the lovers, that love of pleasure has in fact become a religion. Now there are multitudes across the world and all around us here today that may not be described as religious or spiritual in the conventional sense. They may never attend a church building. They may never take any interest in what conventionally we would describe as religious things. But nevertheless, there is a religion that guides them, that grips them. The religion of the harlot here. The religion of self-indulgence. The spirit and philosophy and influence of living for pleasure and living for prosperity. Living only for time and for what may be enjoyed in this world. The religion of the harlot is already alive and well. But as as days go on, as time passes, as we get closer to the return of Christ, that will become the dominant influence in the hearts and lives of men. Now I want us, bearing in mind all that we have said already as we have looked in some detail at the descriptions that are given to us here of this evil, lawless, wicked, polluted, debauched system that governs mankind. I want us to think at this point of the relationship that is spoken of in this passage, the relationship between the harlot and mankind, her relationship to mankind. This evil system presented as this immoral woman, her relationship to mankind, to the populace of the world, is brought to our attention in a number of ways. There is in fact a great deal of emphasis in these verses on the connection between this great whore, mystery, Babylon the Great, and the population of the 10 kingdoms of the Antichrist empire that are identified here. Now, that is chiefly where her influence is going to be seen. That is a part of the earth that Bible prophecy focuses very narrowly upon. The Bible has certain things to say about the world generally that apply in a global sense. But as far as its prophetic statements concerning the future are concerned, the focus is, generally speaking, very narrowly focused upon a particular geographical area. We have looked at this already in our studies in this book and in Daniel as well. That area around the Mediterranean, the old Roman earth, and in its reconstituted 10-kingdom confederacy form. You will see that that's where there is a special link made here between the harlot and mankind. Even though we may say in a general sense, all the earth will be affected by this influence. But primarily this is where the focus of Scripture is. Now, see that she is described in verse 1 as sitting upon many waters. The judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. This is explained for us, interpreted for us in the verse 15. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So we're not left in the dark as to what this is. Here is one aspect of the picture that is used in this vision to describe the relationship between the harlot and the people that she influences. They are as many waters. And then we are taught that these represent peoples, ethnic groups, multitudes, nations, tongues. Now you will see that the emphasis both in the picture and in the explanation is upon diversity. She's sitting upon many waters. And if you imagine even just a picture of the sea and the various currents and countercurrents, and while there is in one sense unity, yet we know that there are all kinds of differences there. And the sea so often seems to be at war with itself, and the waves dashing one against the other and moving this way and that, and the currents going here and there. But there's one thing that unites them. These multitudes, peoples, tongues, ethnic groups, nations, all of these things that divide men, that mark them out into distinct categories and distinct groups, language groups, ethnic groups. But they're brought together in this strange unity under the influence of the Babylonish harlot. You see, there is something strange and miraculous here. Think about the picture that he uses in verse 1. The whore sitteth upon many waters. You ever try to sit on water? It can't be done. Yet here is a strange picture. Where this woman is supported by and influences those that are diverse. You think of the geographical territory that the Antichrist kingdom will cover in this 10-kingdom phase of the Roman Empire, all the way from Portugal in the west right out pretty much to the borders of India. What differences are there? What language groups, ethnic groups? We see even in the current events in some of those Arab countries how that for a time there can be some sort of political unity to overthrow a dictator, but usually when he's gone, all sorts of tribal distinctions come to the fore, and there's the civil war almost breaks out inside the boundaries of these countries. There's such differences. But here is a unity. You know, we have Christians today that are misguided about the subject of unity, and they think unity is the be-all and end-all of everything that is good. There's a unity that is wrong. There is a unity that is hellish. There is a unity that is wicked. There is a religious unity that is not of God but is of the devil. It's a unity that promotes a lie. It's the unity that's seen, for example, in the modern ecumenical movement, in the World Council of Churches. It's the unity that is seen in ever so many different cross-church organizations that bring together this group and that group and the other. And there's no agreement on the truth. There's no consensus on the doctrines of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's no rallying around the core truths of the Bible. Ah, but unity is the great cry. But here's unity that's hellish in the extreme. There's an interesting little reference in the book of Daniel in the chapter 2. We are taught there something about the condition of these nations that make up the 10-kingdom confederacy of the Antichrist. In Daniel chapter 2, the verse 41. Now here, in Daniel's vision, there is a description of these 10 kingdoms under the imagery of the 10 toes of that wonderful image of a man that he saw. Whereas thou sawest the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron. Partly strong, partly broken, we're told, partly brittle. So there's division here. The kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of man, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And again, there's an insight into the diversity and to the fact that while there is a union here of some kind, it's not real union. Just as iron and clay do not really form one composite material, they may be joined together and may stick together in a limited sense, but they never become one compound. And yet here is this same kingdom, diverse, divided, fractious, even in one sense, chafing one against the other, politically, militarily, and yet solidly united under the influence of this evil system, identified here as the harlot of Babylon. More and more, that is what you are going to see. Where it's going to be the philosophy of the harlot that promotes union between the nations of this particular kingdom referred to here. Is that not the great cry today? Settle your differences for prosperity's sake. Settle your differences for the sake of trade, for the sake of commerce. Get past all of these things. Look how good a lifestyle you could have. The pleasure that you can enjoy. That's the harlot talking. Oh, the voice of the harlot can be heard in the diplomatic overtures of much of the developed world today. Bringing together of those that are diverse and opposed one to the other, but bringing them under the rule of this evil philosophy for the sake of pleasure and prosperity. Men will at last find unity in the expression of their lawless rebellion against God. These waters. It's an interesting thing to follow through that picture in the scriptures. The wicked are as a troubled sea when it cannot rest. But it's a sea now dominated by the harlot. There is the appearance of calm. There is the appearance of stability. But it's just an appearance. The kings of the earth, we are told, have formed relationships with this woman. Verse 2, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. Relationships have been formed. This spiritual alliance has been formed. The kings of the earth. Now, reminding you that this is what we could call the prophetic earth that is being spoken of here. These 10 kings. These 10 kingdoms. Their relationships are formed. There is what passes as a loving relationship between the kings of the earth and this evil system. Her influence is seen, therefore, to reach to the highest level of power in these kingdoms. Verse 2, the kings of the earth. Verse 12, the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings. Chapter 18, the verse 3, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. This is a system that is embraced, loved, clung to the highest level of Antichrist's kingdom. The kings of the earth. Truly, this harlot has become the queen of the earth. In chapter 18, in the verse 7, she saith in her heart, I sit a queen, and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. I sit a queen. She is supported, indulged, loved, promoted, embraced by the kings of these kingdoms, raised to the highest level of influence and power. The language that John uses here, of course, is not new. We've seen that so many times before. In Isaiah chapter 47, Isaiah addressed Babylon, pretty much 900 years before John wrote the Revelation. Isaiah was writing his book. Babylon had a different face in Isaiah's day. She was the superpower, the military superpower of the time, and was soon to come to destroy Judah because of her sin. But Isaiah looked far forward into the future when God was going to deal with Babylon. You see, it's the same Babylon. It's where so many make a mistake here. It's the same Babylon. It's the same city. It's the same region. It's the same old wicked religious system. But look at Isaiah 47 and the verse 5. Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of the Kingdoms. Verse 7, thou saidst, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart, neither didst thou remember the latter end of it. Therefore hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thy heart, I am and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. Same old spirit. Was there in Isaiah's day. Now, of course, in the days of Belshazzar, God flattened Babylon, and the Medes and Persians took over, but Babylon never went away. And Babylon will rise again. And the same old spirit, seen again. I am the queen, the lady of the kingdoms. Because the kings of the earth will embrace her. The citizens of these kingdoms are drunk with her foul influence, verse 2. The inhabitants of the earth, again, it's the same geographical territory that's in view here. The citizens of these 10 kingdoms are especially in view. The inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. You know what a drunk man looks like. We have expressions like, when the drink goes in, the wit goes out. There's a man, he's under the control of drink. He does stupid things, dangerous things, because he's intoxicated. He doesn't act with reason. He doesn't act with self-control. But here is a wonderful illustration of the spiritual condition of the citizens of Antichrist's kingdom in this period of time. Like drunk men, intoxicated with pleasure, intoxicated with the pursuit of their own evil lusts, intoxicated with prosperity. They're drunk. Like the helpless, stupefied addict. They give themselves body and soul to the pursuit of this wicked system. Here is an intoxicating religion. Not religion in the conventional sense, as I've said, but nevertheless holding spiritual power over a man, influencing his soul, influencing his spiritual decisions, and they're drunk. Prosperity is an intoxicating thing. Prosperity can be dangerous. There are those, as you know, within the spectrum of what's called Christianity, who teach a prosperity gospel. Prosperity and the gospel do not often go hand in hand. More often than not, it is the wicked that prosper in the earth. Here is a gospel of prosperity, and it makes men drunk with the foul, evil, wicked influence of the Babylonish harlot. It makes them the pathetic playthings of the devil and his false Christ. The totality of governmental authority is under her control at this point. Again, that is brought to our attention in the imagery of the vision here. Verse 9. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, if you look at this vision as a whole, you have the woman presented to us as sitting on three things at the same time. She's sitting on water. She's sitting on the scarlet coloured beast, verse 3, which has these seven heads. And then there is a parallel that is introduced to us in the verse 9 of seven mountains. Seven heads, seven mountains, and waters. Various pictures that are used to describe her influence and her seat, as it were, her support at this time. The heads of the beast are parallel with the seven mountains. I do not believe that in any sense these are seven hills made out of rock and dirt. But rather there are symbols that are used here. The seven heads, the seven mountains, refer to the same thing. Governmental influence. The head governs the body. Here is a beast with seven heads. And you know that in our studies of these things, seven is often the number of completeness or of concentration and of fullness. Here is the concentration of power, of governmental authority. A beast with seven heads that rules these 10 kingdoms. The head governs every action of the body. There's nothing your body can do but the head controls it. Either voluntarily or involuntarily. That's where the control center is based. And here is a woman. And she sits on the seven heads of the beast. And she sits on the seven mountains, which essentially proclaim the same thing. It's interesting just to see how in Scripture a mountain is used in to convey this concept. If you look, for example, at Daniel. No, let's take Jeremiah first. Jeremiah 51, in the verse 25. Now in this passage, one of the vital passages of the Old Testament with relation to Babylon, you'll see this terminology used. I will render unto Babylon, verse 24, and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea, all their evil that they have done in Zion in your sight, saith the Lord. Behold, I am against thee. Who's the thee? Babylon, in Chaldea. Not a question about who he's talking about. O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyeth the other. Babylon's not a mountain. There's not a mountain there. But it's described as a mountain because of its influence, because of its rule, because of its authority and power. Dominating the landscape politically and militarily. And influencing every detail of life. In the book of Daniel, we have another mountain. This time it's a different government, a different kingdom. It is in fact the kingdom of Christ that will be set up in the earth as he appears. Daniel 2, 45, well, take 44, in the days of these kings, that's the 10 kings that we're thinking of, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now there's the doctrine, there's the teaching, there's the explanation. But now we're brought again to the picture that's used in this vision. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, and the silver, and the gold, and the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. Here is a stone that becomes a mountain. It fills the earth. Verse 35, the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And we're told, this is but a picture of Christ's kingdom. Here is a mountain. And it's used as the illustration of the kingdom. The rule of Christ as king with a rod of iron in the earth that will follow his return. And so that governmental authority and power that
subsists in the Antichrist, even at this point. You've got the ten kings. You've got the Antichrist here, this scarlet-coloured seven-headed beast with ten horns. He's there. But he's under her control. He's under her dominion. Her power and authority. Now the Antichrist, as I've said, is recognizable at this point. But he hasn't yet come to the place of full and final prominence as the man of sin. That will only come after verse 16 of this chapter, where he in fact rises up now and destroys the harlot. We'll have to come back to it next time to see this. That it is at that point that he emerges as the man of sin, having shaken off all other power and authority. And he steps out onto the world stage and says, I am God. And the final 3.5 years of the age begin. But he's recognizable here. He's visible. He's identifiable as the beast. The rule of Antichrist's empire for a time will be wholly disposed to support the harlot. He will be the political and the military machine that implements the moral influences of this evil Babylonish system. He will be the strong arm. We read of this woman drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Already the Antichrist has been flexing his political and military muscles. Even in that territory. Oh, things have not yet reached their full development as far as the ten kings, the final ten kings, are concerned. We're told that here. He still has to step up one more step to that place of political prominence and take over. But he's busy. Already he's the scarlet-coloured beast. The bloodthirsty, devilish agent of the evil harlot. She rides the beast. She controls him. His government. His authority. His power. His kingdom. Under her control. It's a strange thing. A paradox. In many ways. Many of the nations that are going to be caught up in this Ten Kingdom Confederacy pride themselves among the most developed and the most free and the most free-thinking nations in the world. And all the while they're sinking under the control of this harlot, living for the indulgence of wicked, licentious, self-seeking pleasure. While they pride themselves on being free, more and more they are becoming the intoxicated slaves of apostasy and wickedness, and preparing the way for the emergence of the Antichrist. More and more, the governments of these countries are going to be legislating wickedness, legislating sin, adopting legislative policies and social policies that promote the ideology of the harlot. You know, you can trace these things even in social policies across the world today, where there is more of a concentration upon leisure and pleasure than there is upon plain old-fashioned work, where there is more and more a concentration upon the liberty of men to live in whatever wicked, evil way they wanted. I read an article just in this last week where It's in one of the states in the U.S. where you remember whenever there was all the discussion about legislating on same-sex marriages. And some of the opponents of that legislation said, well, you know, if you allow this, then they're going to argue for this form of deviance and that form of deviance, and it'll soon be just a free-for-all. Oh, no, that will not ever happen. That couldn't happen. Already, those legal decisions are being argued in court right now for the legalization of incest. Right now. And more social legislation and social practice is going to be the vehicle to advance the philosophy of the harlot. Let us recognize it for what it is. There may not be much we can do to stop it, such as the juggernaut of apostasy in the end times, but we can at least recognize it and witness against it. This is Babylon at work. And even though we may be geographically removed from the territory that's spoken of here in Revelation 17, and where the great epicenter of all of these events will occur, yet the same thing is working here. The same intoxicating influences that appeal to man's desire for pleasure and for self-indulgence. Working here. The drug culture, the drink culture, the culture of immorality and license and promiscuity. It's the influence of the harlot. It's the religion of the last days. And the political machinery of Antichrist will promote it. And it's but another step on toward the end. And the man of sin will finally emerge on the stage of the world. We're going to leave it there for now. We're going to come back to consider the fact that the harlot will one day give way to the beast, as we see in this chapter. And the man of sin will emerge. We'll look at that next time in the will of God.